Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is one of my favorite episodes of the month. It is the Thai Atlanta special. And with me today, I have KP Reddy. Welcome, KP.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And KP, you're a charter member of Thai. Were you a founding member as well?
Not a founder, but I've been
pretty
there
close,
since 98.
Been a while.
Yes.
And you brought with you Hans Utz.
He came on his own.
He came on his own separately.
separately,
but equal. Okay, very nice. KP, why don't we start out and just kind of re-educate our listeners about Thai? What are you guys doing for folks?
Yeah, so Thai is a global organization, nonprofit, and we help entrepreneurs grow and start companies, grow companies. And we're global in nature, started in Silicon Valley. Used to be heavily technology focused. The Atlanta chapter actually has a pretty good balance of technology and other businesses.
And that's what makes it kind of unique, where it isn't just exclusively technology focused, where there's a lot of organizations that serve that niche.
Exactly. And we're helping entrepreneurs from high school students to college students to entrepreneurs that have $50 million a year businesses. So we're helping entrepreneurs at all stages of development.
And also, even if they've kind of retired and just want to get back to the community, there's a place for those people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where we re-engage a lot with our folks that have exits and kind of have some time on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those are charter members.
And my favorite part about Thai, the charter members have to pay to volunteer.
Yeah,
that's kind of a unique approach.
Great model. It's one way to get people's attention.
So maybe you could build a business model around that as well. You think that'll work in the real world out there?
Yeah, it's an interesting model. You know, I think the, you know, like any nonprofit organizations, as you grow, there's economic cycles, and we've all hung in there during the downs and pitched in and have made it a priority. And I think that's where, when you talk to high net worth individuals that are successful, the best way to get their attention is to get them to write a check.
And then they're more invested.
They're more invested.
So now, today we're going to talk about the subject matter of an upcoming Thai, one of their monthly meetings on August 12th. There's a meeting at the Sheraton here in Sandy Springs that you're bringing together enterprise and entrepreneurs.
Exactly. So we launched a program as one of our programs called E2E several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had pretty good success with it. We're trying to really punch it up. But the idea is large companies would like to do business with small companies and startups, et cetera.
Well, they say they would.
Well, they say they would, right. And they have procurement people that are supposed to be working on
and
that.
And those are the exact right people that should be finding entrepreneurs.
Absolutely.
Right? The procurement people?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Lawyers help a little bit.
Lawyers, those are really good, too.
Sometimes the accountants
HR, maybe, that would be good.
That exactly.
Trifecta would really kind of find that next diamond in the rough, right?
Absolutely. And what you learn is there's kind of the challenge is big companies don't have the time or the right resources mm-hmm. to work with the small companies. And the small companies are generally ill-equipped to work with big companies.
Right.
So E2E launched was really to help both from an educational perspective, but then honestly, you know, like you mentioned, our charter members are highly successful, highly connected. Sometimes they can just pick up the phone and make things happen.
Like they can expedite the relationship.
Absolutely.
And then maybe they can help the entrepreneur may position what they have in a way that an enterprise can understand it and use it.
Absolutely. I think part of it is the reality that an entrepreneur needs to hear. You know, everybody wants to do business with Coke, Delta, and everyone else.
Well, they think they do, at least.
Right. Right. Exactly. Till they do. But
they may not like how the payment process works.
Right.
It might be slower than they're anticipating.
A little bit slower.
What you find a lot with these big businesses is that you may think you're talking to the decision maker, but there's significant more complexity in a large organization about mm-hmm. how to arrive at a purchase decision than just, oh, I have an interested client.
Right.
You've got folks that influence the decision, folks that can approve the decision. The individual that has the budget may not be even remotely related to
right.
what it is that you're doing. And so walking through some of those complexities with an entrepreneur can be eye-opening for them.
And don't forget the politically connected person that can sabotage the whole thing because it's not in their best interest.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of landmines.
No, and I think the main thing with Thai is because we work with technology and services, sometimes people can't hear that what they really do is provide staffing or contract labor. And
right.
they're like, no, we're innovative. It's like, no, actually you provide labor, and procurement's probably the best path. And I think that's why when we kind of assembled the panel For the August 12th event, we try to really give a good broad view of
like a 360 view.
Yeah, because not everything, you know, large companies talk about buying innovation, but a lot of times they just need bodies.
Right.
They just need resources or they need to implement software. It's not that innovative, but they still send a lot of work out.
Right. And they have the budgets that can really make a difference to some of these entrepreneurs.
Yes.
So now, do you know who's on the panel? Has that been decided?
Absolutely. So we have Arul, who is one of our charter members. So he's kind of representing the small business that's he's landed contracts with Facebook and some of the larger companies. So he's going to talk about his experiences from being kind of the small, you know, small business trying to do business. And he mostly does consulting. So he's not really selling, you know, innovation per se. He's selling resourcing and capability. And then we have David Harvey, who Senior VP of Products for Athena Health, who very interesting. You know, we're fortunate to get his time. He actually sold his company to Athena when they were much smaller. I think Athena's on track to do $1 billion in revenue this year. He runs the facility over at Ponce City Market with several hundred developers. So he came in from the entrepreneur realm, and now he's kind of a corporate person.
Right.
But he also drives a lot of the work with the entrepreneurial and the startup community and is charged with that. So he's going to talk a little bit about his journey from being an entrepreneur and being bought by a big company. Most of us, I've had those exits where you get bought by a large company and you're lucky if you last a year. It's just, but he's been there for several years. He's made it through.
And your buddy Hans over here, isn't he part of that panel?
Yes. So Hans is part of the panel too. So Hans is with the Combine, which is a venture that we started earlier this year, and I'll let Hans talk a little bit more about.
Hans, why don't you share a little bit about your background, because it's kind of interesting.
Done a couple iterations of industries. I came out of management consulting. I actually spent several years working for Mayor Reed, helping operate the city, deputy COO. And it was through some of that work, trying to figure out how at a policy level to better engage the large businesses in our community with some of the startups to help what we were calling supercharge the startup ecosystem here in Atlanta, that I ran into KP. And I think through our conversations with some of the CEOs and with a lot of the small businesses, we realized that there was this gap in the market, I call it a broker, if you will, or somebody that can play the intermediary.
The matchmaker, right?
Correct. Exactly. And more than just make the match, but actually drive towards some sort of a transaction.
Relationship, right?
Yes, exactly.
Not just superficial. Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Yeah, right? We wanted somebody that could continue to crack the whip on both sides of that relationship to get it to a point where there was a contract in place. And so that's the thesis of the Combine. We are helping large companies source innovation to solve strategic problems that they have from smaller startup, maybe more entrepreneurial and fast moving companies that are in market.
Now, do you think that was having the mayor be the catalyst? Do you think that helped speed this process up? KP, smiling.
I think certainly having access like that is helpful. I think good government knows when to get out of the way, I think is the best answer to provide. And he's done a great job of that, making the connections, but not
so just be the connector rather than the, you know, kind of the whip of saying, hey, this is how it's going to be. You guys are going to partner and this, I'm going to make a law that says that 10% of your
budget. We don't want that. The best role that political leaders can play in an economic environment is as cheerleaders for that particular environment. Right. I mean, so you want them out there talking about how great Atlanta is, how great it is to do business in Atlanta. Come pay attention to Atlanta. That's what you want. You don't want laws that start requiring things, especially since we're all figuring this out, right? I mean, the last thing we want to do is lock something up that doesn't work.
Now, but did you see that actually create relationships when the mayor is going to these companies? Did that get them actually interacting with entrepreneurs?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of interest, I think, at an executive level in this market for trying to solve this problem. Now, there are a number of different ways to do it, and there's a number of different activities underway, and I think we welcome all of that. It's necessary that we, you know, let's throw a whole lot of stuff at the wall and see what sticks, right? Because if we're successful, rising tide lifts all boats.
So now, and that kind of mentality probably resonates with you, KP, because that's kind of a startup mentality, right?
No, absolutely, and I think you know, we launched in January. We've engaged with some clients. We're continuing to figure some things out. And I think one of the things that we have realized too, that while we're Atlanta focused and here in Atlanta, some markets are more interested in what we're doing. So we're having to, I think about that a little bit differently. I think the other thing that we're realizing is that this intermediary position is really about kind of better term, keeping secrets. The large companies want to do things and they can't publicly talk about the things that they're doing and why it's not working. And then startups tend to embellish, right?
Right. That everything's bigger.
Right. Everything, you know, product's already done. You know? Right. And so we have, because we have reputational risk, and we have to make sure that both parties are equipped to really do business with each other and then have those conversations that say, look, you know, you're really not ready to go in front of this client, or you are, but here's the risk. And we have to be open with the end customer, the large company, to say, look, I think we need to put some risk mitigation in process. If you wanted to really do business with this company, mm-hmm. I think you should, but here's what the reality of where they are. You know, they have 2 months of payroll.
If you're going to do something, now's the time.
Yeah, or just make sure that you have a plan B. So right. A lot of it is, you know, the big companies don't like to share their challenges. The little companies definitely, you know,
they're not
going to share any of that.
Well, if they have a meeting with that big company, believe me, that's on their website of this, you know, launching soon.
Right, exactly. So we have to make sure that, you know, because we're not about, what, you know, a deal and out. We have to keep doing business.
Right. But is your client primarily the enterprise or the entrepreneur or the relationship?
It's both. It's both. We're seeing the larger companies, quite honestly, as a startup, you look at who's going to pay you the most, the fastest and the best, right? And the large companies are just better equipped to that.
Right.
The startups, we do a lot of free counseling. They come in and we say, look, and they want to do business with us. And we say, look,
sure.
We're just not ready. You know, we'd love to do business with you. We like you. You like your product. Let's put some 3 month, 6 month milestones that you think you'll hit. You go do that and come back and see us in 3 to 6 months, and then we'll have a better sense of where you are.
And then from the enterprise level, what does the relationship look like?
Well, often at an enterprise level, it ends up having to be a very senior relationship, often at a C-suite. And the reason for that, if you think about it, the whole point of innovation is to disrupt how some things are currently done.
Right.
And so you'll find a lot of times some of these startups will be offering products or services that don't neatly match into existing functional roles or existing buyers within the organization. It's still a fantastic capability that the large organization wants, but it just doesn't look like anything they've bought before. Whose budget pays for that? And
right.
Who's the one responsible for implementing it? And who takes
the heat if it doesn't work?
That's right. And when those things cross different functional departments, it really requires a senior leader to step up and say, let's make this happen.
Right.
We want to make this happen. And so we find that if we're too far down in the organization, you just can't get the traction and you can't get that kind of product bought.
Yeah.
So culture from a standpoint from the enterprise is very important, right? They have to culturally be committed to this endeavor. This is not just kind of a superficial relationship
you're dealing with here. We have the large companies coming to us at the C-suite saying, look, we have this business unit. If we don't disrupt ourselves or cannibalize ourselves, someone else will. So let's have that conversation of how you guys can help us essentially cannibalize or disrupt an existing business unit.
And those within their company.
Right, within their company.
Right, so the lower person that runs that disruptee, you know, the one that's being disrupted, they're not going to be like, yeah, let's do that.
Exactly. So a lot of our conversations happen offsite. A lot of our conversations are really about how do you disrupt existing business. And to small companies, it doesn't make sense, right? Why would you want to put a $50 million year revenue business out of business? And what they don't understand is that a lot of these large companies are under great pressure to return the right level of earnings, the right level of margins. And when you might be $50 million, anyone in this room would love a $50 million revenue business. However, if it's not hitting, you know, if it's bringing the entire organization down or it's not strategic, then there's reasons to do something to it.
And so when you're having that level of conversation, now they say they're open to this disruption or being disrupted. Now, are you going out and, you know, running Craigslist ads to find an entrepreneur that's going to do that? Or you're coming with an entrepreneur in hand that already has something going? How does that, you know, kind of match?
I would say all of the above. Yeah, I mean, so part of the issue is being very clear definitionally what it is that the large company is looking for. Because often they're not completely clear themselves. And right. so there's a fair bit of work on that side to make them comfortable with what the scope of their actual problem is. This looks different. And then when you go out with a better sense of what it is that you're looking for, we talk to folks that run funds and we take a look at portfolios and we dig in deeper. And many times we'll find very innovative and very capable startups that are close, but not quite what the big company is looking for. We
right.
can have a conversation with that startup and say, if you make a slight pivot to this product, or if you add a feature to this product, I can put you in front of company X, right? And so that it's a very much an evolving two-way conversation.
Mm-hmm. And so then both sides have to have a lot of patience to work with you guys, right?
I think that's that's safe to say, yes.
But that, I mean, an entrepreneur, patience usually isn't their core competency. Well,
I don't think it's patience. I mean, I think they have to have patience. We're very impatient, right? We're not going to say, you know, but I think there's certain realities, and entrepreneurs tend to focus on the things that they're good at and they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have to challenge them to say, look, that's all great, but here are the three things you need to do. And if you can't do them, then either you need to bring in a business partner, hire some, whatever it is. So we give, you know, for the value of what, you know, we get paid a lot of times with these entrepreneurs, a lot of free counseling. They get a lot back, but 90% of the time we're not telling them what they want to hear. Because there's a reason why they, you know, if they come to us, there's a reason why they haven't already done business with the large companies.
Right.
There's a reason. It's not just that they haven't had the opportunity. There are structural fundamental reasons to their technology, their business, et cetera, that they haven't already engaged with large companies. And that's where we have to kind of help them fix it.
But in some cases, are they just not pursuing large companies, or they don't think that's doable?
They're not pursuing them. You know, they view it's all about contacts. What they mm-hmm. don't realize a lot of times is just that you have to have a different approach. A lot of these, you know, in this market with freemium models, you know, $25 a month SaaS services,
right.
that just, they focus so much time and energy around that when they get in front of a large customer. They don't even know how to engage with them.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these companies have just never been there. You know, part of it is just the repetition of selling seven-figure deals all day long.
Yeah, if you take a look at, name a large company with a big employee base, you could use Home Depot as an example. They're not going to buy a $25 per user
right.
per month license.
Right, they like wouldn't even consider it. Right. right.
Completely unscalable purchase on their part. So it's about helping educate some of these smaller companies what's required to really operate at an enterprise level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's startling, right? I mean, I made the comment a few minutes ago, but if you talk to somebody and say, look, you may have an interested client, but they're not the actual decision maker on this product. The actual decision maker on the product is so-and-so, but they're not the ones that hold the budget. And at the end of the day, you have to make these three people that are in the IT department able to sign off on it before it can get through purchasing. You know, that just the complexity of engaging appropriately with an enterprise is daunting.
And right. Well, it's a different skill set, isn't it? I mean, you know, the small guy is probably running pay-per-click and LinkedIn ads and yep. using, you know, marketing automation stuff, and that's not going to get to the Home Depot C-suite to buy.
Absolutely, and we have the good fortune of spending lots of time with, you know, Fortune 500 C-suite. That's what we do. That's our job. And the narrative that entrepreneurs have around big companies just don't get it. Maybe. You know, they're still multi-billion dollar enterprises.
Right. They get a lot of things, you know.
generating more cash on any given day than you'll ever see in your lifetime.
Right.
However, they don't get it, right? So part of it's helping them understand, like, they do get it. It's just that it's different. And how the words you choose, the way you approach it, the way you price it, and understand that for most large companies, the risk of failure is greater than the opportunity, you know, put in front
right.
of them. So you just have to help them. And I get amazed at how many startups, they don't even know how to read a 10K or a 10Q. Actually, some of them don't even know what a 10K or a 10Q is. And they want to go do business with these large companies. And it's like, you have to understand what their business model is. You have to understand how they make earnings, what the risks are. And the beautiful thing about large public companies is if you read, there's lots of gold in those filings.
Right. They have to disclose a lot of things.
Absolutely. I think there was something out this morning just saying that now they have to disclose the parity around the CEO's compensation against the average wage of their employee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that tells you a lot. I mean, there's all that information is there, right? So if you're a startup and you're trying to figure out how to do business with a large company, you have to understand their business.
So now you mentioned that this thing launched in January. Mm-hmm. Have you had any kind of opportunities to actually make a match or do business?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're continuing to do different things. You know, the good news of working with large companies is mostly it's, under confidentiality and cloak and dagger. And what's starting to happen now is the large companies are kind of giving us shopping lists and saying, go find us things like this. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to go back and forth with them. It's like, it's not really like this. It's more like that.
Right. Does that work or this?
Right. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of, acquiring shopping lists and hunting.
And then it's based here in Atlanta, you mentioned. Was that just because you guys are from Atlanta? Or is this strategically the right place in America to be doing this?
I think there's some value in Atlanta specifically. This has it's the third highest concentration of Fortune 500s in the country. The highest concentration of Fortune 500s that don't compete with one another, right? And that's an important point. If you go to New York and you're an entrepreneur, you land Goldman Sachs as a client, that's fantastic, right? I mean,
right.
They're a great flagship client, but they're going to have a contract with you that locks you out of Merrill Lynch and locks you out of everyone else in that finance stack, right? Well, that's 60% of New York's market. Houston with oil and gas, it's going to be similar, right? So here in Atlanta, if you get Coca-Cola as a client, they might introduce you to Delta if you're a great supplier, right? And so there's just the opportunity to access very, very large companies in a way that's more open and available than it would be in some of the other markets.
And what about any, I know you guys are working with Tie, are there any other business associations that have kind of embraced this?
Well, we're actually just helping Tie out for this event. Quite honestly, because we are focused on technology-driven, somewhat a little bit of IP, IP-driven companies, I would say most of the Thai community, it's a small percentage that would actually be prospects for us. So this is more just us giving time back to the community. And I think it's really important. I mean, the August 12th session is not going to be us talking at you. It's definitely going to be very interactive. And we also have Burt Carrington, who for 20 years ran supplier diversity at Wachovia and other large companies. As you know, Ty, a lot of the membership base is minority women-owned businesses. So it's going to be a great opportunity for them to ask questions about how do I leverage that as an unfair advantage to get into these large companies. Hans will be there to talk about how you can drive innovation and an innovative narrative to get into large companies. Then we'll have David Harvey there from Athena talking about how can you do business with Athena. Let me tell you what my experience has been. And then we have a rule that's doing business, as a small, mm-hmm. as a smaller company doing business. So I think we'll have a lot of really good people to do a lot of Q&A. So I keep getting pinged, what's the agenda? The agenda is you show up and you ask lots of good questions. And if we can't answer them, I'd be shocked.
Now, how about some tips for the entrepreneur that wants to do business with the enterprise? You mentioned some of the things of just doing your research and, reading some of their annual reports and some of the documents that are public. Are there any other tips for an entrepreneur that wants to get into this world with enterprise?
Yeah, I think one, just conceptually, is that there's kind of this impedance mismatch that entrepreneurs want things signed in 90 days. I continue to do business. I've done business with large companies for most of my career. It's not unusual to have a one-year sales cycle. And it's also not unusual a year later to get a phone call saying, hey, we're ready to go.
Out of the blue.
Right.
Like you thought it was dead. Right.
And by the way, you said it was 250. I got you a PO for $1 million because I needed to get the right. It's one of those odd things. We had budget left.
Right. So Now it's a hurry, right?
Now it's a hurry. Can you deliver by the end of the month? So you have to kind of have
go with the flow with that.
Yeah, I think and that's why a lot of startups just don't understand how to manage their sales pipeline and really the optimism gets in the way of reality sometimes mm-hmm. in terms of sales forecasting.
The other thing that I would say, we talked a lot about the decision rules in large companies around procurement and buying. It's important for the startup to understand how that works, so as to best be able to subvert them. Part of it, I would not tell a startup that your best way to do business is to engage wholly with the procurement department and be perfectly to the T on everything that they say, because that's a great way to have a 24 to 48 month sales cycle, right? if you can find the decision maker, go find that decision maker. If you can find somebody that has their own credit card that can trial your product, go find that person. I mean, if there's anything that you can do to get your product or capability into that company and get it used, that's the best way to drive sales.
Because right? Then you now have data points that are real based on their world.
You have champions inside the organization mm-hmm. that are pushing for it. I mean, the best way to get an IT department to support your product is to have it already within the department. Right? And I mean, that's a bit subversive, and I suspect some of our Fortune 500 clients are going to ask me to not say that again. But I mean, the reality is that if you really want to make a sale and you have something that's that excellent, you need to understand how the company operates extremely well to learn how to best approach it.
Now, what about Hans? Maybe you can answer this. There's some government programs that match kind of mentor protege programs with large organizations and maybe minority firms. Is that a path as well?
We've explored that some. There's, I think there's a lot of great work being done at the AUC, the Atlanta University Center, some of the HBCs that are there around identifying minority entrepreneurs and ensuring they're getting the support. And the really, what happens a lot in the tech community and in the entrepreneurial community is that your success is somewhat predicated upon your network. And there are absolutely network effects in play here. And so I think it's extremely important to be conscious about compensating for where those networks may not be as strong or have been as robust. And so when you're talking about some of the minority entrepreneurs, and when you're talking about women entrepreneurs, for example, it is very important to support that. And I think that some of the programs, there's the Women's Entrepreneurship Center that is effectively an accelerator incubator downtown. Clark Atlanta University is doing some really interesting entrepreneurial programs on their campus. And so yes, I think these are important to support, and we are available and interested in being engaged in that in any way possible.
And then next steps for you guys for this venture?
I think just we're going to keep doing what we're doing. I mean, we're now starting to look at our growth. You know, we preach scalable, high scalable businesses, and
do you hold yourself to the same standard you hold the entrepreneur?
We absolutely do. We do, but we have to remind ourselves. And that's one good thing about having partners and not going it alone is we can continuously kind of hold it, you know, remind ourselves, is that what we really wanted to do? Is that why we're doing mm-hmm. Because we get a lot of opportunities for just straight out, you know, hourly consulting and, you know, to do business consulting because we do have a lot of background. And it's very easy to say, oh, yeah, let's do it. But we have to kind of check ourselves a little bit and remind ourselves that's not really what we're building here.
Right, because you're trying to build this. Well, you tell me what you're trying to build.
Well, I mean, so the
it's here in Atlanta. You want to be known as the people that make these connections?
Absolutely.
And facilitate right. these relationships. But then are you looking also to scale outside of Atlanta?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, when we're talking about finding startups, it has to be larger than just Atlanta. Right.
Right.
I mean, so we're scouting really all over the globe, but certainly across the U.S. for startups that can solve some of the issues that these big companies have. I think our thesis there, from a policy standpoint, if I can say it, is if we're capable of getting you business with Coca-Cola and Home Depot, for example, you pretty much need to have an office in Atlanta, if not be headquartered in Atlanta. I mean, that's a great way to ensure that you're going to have a presence in this market. And mm-hmm. so that's been our theory so far. In terms of scalability, I think that what KP and I have this conversation all the time. We tell entrepreneurs that they need to be ready to pivot if what they're currently doing isn't getting them the traction or the success that they want to see. And so I mean, almost once a month having that conversation about, you know, do we need to tweak our programming? Do we need to tweak our offerings? How, if what we're doing here, is this something that we can step back from and it still be successful? In other words, it can be scalable? Or is this something that requires 100% of our time for forever and thus is not scalable?
Right.
And so we're constantly making those adjustments as we move along.
I think one of the things we've pretty much held true, we pivoted and cleaned up and gotten more focused. Is the problem statement still, you know, the hypothesis and the problem statement is still sound and exists? I think what we are continually asking ourselves is how do we monetize solving that problem and how do we maximize the monetization of that? We could go do consulting, right? We could get retainers from small companies and go help sell seven-figure deals. Well, that would be me and Hans doing that. And we're extremely busy, and you know, and that's not a great leverage and scale of our time. So I think what we're constantly, I don't think we've really pivoted much from the problem statement or the hypothesis. I think it's how we solve it and how we work to solve it. I think that's where we're kind of continuously questioning ourselves and saying, well, that would be a great gig, but that's not really scalable for us.
And I'll give you an example of some of the challenge that we've faced, right? So KP mentioned that the thesis and the theory and the need in the market is still there. As we've become more nuanced in our understanding about how the market works, one of the problems that we've seen is that there isn't really a driver to decision for those large companies. There isn't you know, a sword hanging over their head.
Right.
Saying,
there's
you
no
have
sense
to
of urgency. Solve this today.
Correct. Correct. And so how do you drive them to a decision around innovation? Mm-hmm. It's always something that can be done tomorrow.
And it's an easier no. Like
precisely. So that's a huge challenge in trying to drive business in this market. And so developing products and developing a pitch and developing a program that solves the problem that we clearly recognize, but does it in a way that establishes that sense of urgency for the large companies is something that we struggle with.
And you're solving a problem that is a hypothetical and you don't have the ready solution. So they know there's a general problem, but you don't have the specific answer to a specific problem. So it's kind of they have to kind of believe in the philosophy.
They do. Fortunately, there are plenty of examples of companies that get caught completely unawares,
right?
Pants down.
But it's other companies, not them.
That's true. That is absolutely
true. Because they're different,
true.
Because they have this other great thing. That these
you should hire them and then come out and talk to some of these companies. Yeah, so, that's exactly right.
And to create that sense of urgency. So how are you getting around that? How are you creating that sense of urgency?
Well, besides taunting them.
making fun of them yeah. or showing it. Look at this big company that went out of business.
Yeah,
you know?
No, well, I think I've gone on record over and over again tweeting and you know that innovations, there's no innovation happening at innovation centers.
Okay.
Which is pretty factual. You know, so you look at all these innovation centers that the large companies are setting up, they become really just recruiting models to get the younger generation engaged in, you know, being excited about working at a hardware store was a quote. Was a quote I heard from management. You know, so I think everyone has to go through that cycle, right? They have to go through that cycle of, oh, let's you know, and it's baby steps. Let's get involved with this incubator, let's get involved with this accelerator. And these are all small investments, right? These from a corporate level, these are tiny investments.
Right. This is pocket change for
these guys. And we've already seen feedback where they've spent money on an innovation center or sponsoring an incubator or whatever, and they're coming back and saying, hey, we've learned a lot now. Now it might be time for us to up an investment and see what happens. So a lot of these moves, I mean, I am not against innovation centers. I think they are a great baby step. You know, for a large company to spend $1 million or whatever. To do an innovation
just from
center.
PR standpoint, they're going to win.
It's cheaper than paying recruiters, right?
Well, and it is. There is a recruiting problem with the current millennial generation. I mean, people want to live in town and they want to be doing entrepreneurial things.
Right.
This is established, right? And so, how do you put your business forward in such a way if what you have as your headquarters is primarily a cubicle farm way out in the suburbs? How do you attract some of this younger talent? And mm-hmm. that's innovation centers are a great way to do that. I would not tell a large company not to do it. It's from that standpoint.
And then you see companies. I mean, David Harvey, he'll talk about it at the Thai event. But Ponce City Market, when Athena signed up for that lease, their executive management thought they were insane. Like we might get shot. You know, it was that bad when they were developing that. But you know, guys like David and others at Athena had a great vision around this idea of like, if we're going to scale 600 people in this market, where are these people going to come from, and how can we impact the community, and how can we be forget about riding the coattails of something that's happening? How can we become a beacon for what's happening in a community and draw and use our resources? And I mean, look at it. They've you have MailChimp over there, you have Athena over there, and they have created this great kind of clustering of opportunity for younger folks to go work and have the right lifestyle and everything else. And I think the same is true with innovation centers.
Now, you've gone on record of saying, I believe this is so, that young people should explore a startup early in their lives. Yeah. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think I always relate it to physicians. You go to med school and then you go do your residency. And by doing your residency, you learn every aspect of everything under all the different time constraints and all of it, right? You make all your rotations and you learn about everything.
On 2 hours of sleep a night, exactly. Sustained for multiple weeks.
Yeah, it's, for it's, Red Bull and pizza.
Right? Exactly. So to me, a startup is no different.
It's that.
Right? It's exactly that. Go, you know, you graduate from college, go spend 2 years at a startup.
So you believe in college? You're still on the college?
College is absolute.
Okay. It's not everybody's in that camp.
Well, usually people that didn't go to college say that. Peter does. But I even think the way universities are shifting, you know, when we have conversations with universities, they're starting to understand that the way they structure and the goal setting. I mean, Peter Thiel talks about like universities ruining the best and the brightest because of this kind of parochial system that's in place. And you're starting to see, you know, institutions like Georgia Tech and Georgia State, to a certain degree, all starting to really listen. It didn't, you know, in the last several years, the amount of listening that I've seen universities doing has been unparalleled. I mean, even Stanford and MIT that, quote unquote, have it right, they're still listening a lot and are constantly trying to drive something different. It's definitely not this mentality of it ain't broke, don't fix it. Going to college, getting your, you know, master's and PhD, I think that's all important things. For the future, you have to know things, right? But once you get out, going to work for a startup and working on 2 hours sleep and, you know, kind of like a physician in residency, right. You learn everything about what goes into a business. And you also learn what a bad hire looks like. You know, a bad hire in a 1,000-person organization gets buried. A bad hire in a 4-person organization gets vetted on the second day, right? And I think for me, as a student, getting out, going and working 2 years at a startup is no different than a residency, and they will be just elitely equipped to go work at a GE or a Home Depot or someone else because it's not all these departments. They actually understand what HR is. They actually understand what marketing is and sales at a very close level.
And the speed that you're learning the stuff and the way it changes, it shapes you for the rest of your career, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, Hans, you let's take KP's thesis and then put it for politicians. You think every politician should work at a startup?
I think that
sounds like a new reality show.
No, really. I mean,
I think you're underestimating the complexity and demand of running a successful campaign.
But a politician, forget about maybe the person that's in office, but just the whole staff around them. Don't you think that they would be served by having to make payroll, not make payroll, you know, failing and succeeding and seeing the levers of that and then make policy?
I think that there is certainly, there are roles where business sense, where determination and where policy understanding or strategic grasp of the issues are all critical. And if you are missing one of the legs of that stool, then you're going to be less effective. Just you're going to be less effective in that role. I think that at fairly senior levels, that you tend to find people who have those skill sets, or you're extremely unsuccessful very quickly. But no, in theory, yes, I think that would be, that's a good thing. The broader the base of experience and the wider range of activities that an individual is engaged in, I think more prepared they're going to be to face what happens in a policy environment. I mean, just speaking from my experience at the city, the range of issues that you grapple with, and in many cases, life and death issues that you grapple with every single day is unparalleled, right? There's no organization and there's no commercial enterprise, I should say, that on one day might deal with a municipal water system shutting down, on another day might deal with people firing at their police officers, on another day might deal with, right? I mean, there's just a huge range.
The stakes are higher.
Extremely high, right? The ability to have incredible impact, though, is also extremely high. And so anybody that's considering it, I would say it's a good, I would say, additional experience to add to your career. But yes, those individuals that are there should have as wide a range of experience as possible.
It is interesting. I mean, the analogous to being on a campaign. I did participate in a campaign, and it's pretty much like a startup. I mean, limited resources, everybody's selling, everybody's delivering, everybody's working crazy amount of hours for no money.
one weak hand in that lot can really mess it up.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's...
And you're the thing in a campaign, you're driving for one day, right? The win or lose.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the startup...
It's kind of similar. So I will amend it.
That sounds like a blog post for you.
Right. I will amend it. Every student should either work for a startup or a campaign.
All right. So if somebody, what do you guys need more of? Do you need more enterprise or more entrepreneurs?
I'd actually say enterprise. I think the entrepreneurs are there, and the speed. The beautiful thing about innovation is it adapts quickly to market demands. Right. I want to see more market demand, mm-hmm. and that really is on the enterprise side. Yeah. I think there are folks who get it. I think that we talked a little bit before we came on the air. There are companies out there who structurally have to innovate for what the business that they're in. You know, we talk about companies like GE, mm-hmm. W.L. Gore, right? There's other companies like this. Siemens is a great example. These companies, huge engineering companies, basically what they do is R&D.
Right, that's their business.
products that spit out at the end. They don't need our help. They have divisions of people that look like us.
Right.
They're scouting for everything out there.
Or if they need our help, they have a process. I mean, they've already done business with people like us.
You know,
that was our realization, that a W.L. Gore and S.C. Johnson Wax that have, believe it, P&G that have huge R&D departments. When we talk to them, then we get sent over to the R&D department. They're like, oh, yeah, here's how we work with you. I mean, they already know the program of how to work with us, because they're truly driving innovation.
It's interesting when you talk to some of the other companies in there, they don't quite understand what we do because it is different from the way they've typically engaged. Whereas it may have been W.L. Gore that we talked to, but they said, oh, you're a scout. Yeah, here's the people that you need to talk to.
I didn't know I was a scout.
Here's the contract and here's what it looks like. And we're like, this is the easiest conversation I've had yet, right? But it is very different. And it is, I think the dynamic around companies that are really driving innovation versus companies that are trying to but still trying to figure it out, you can absolutely see it in the sophistication of how they engage.
But it's not necessarily the industry, it's a company by company. So some companies just might have that as part of their DNA.
No, I think that you can draw lines around certain industries, right? I mean, it is, you're not incorrect. There are companies that are better at it than others. But I think certain industries that
lend itself.
Correct.
And there's certain metrics you can look at, right? I mean, all this is, how much they spend on R&D is publicly available. Are they increasing their spend on R&D? How is it a percentage of revenue, percentage of earnings of the company? There's a lot of key metrics that take you beyond, if a CEO comes out and says, oh, we're all about innovation, and they've cut their R&D budget the last 3 years. Maybe. He's full of...
Right.
They're so not about innovation.
They're saying something and doing something else.
Well, there are a lot of companies that innovate for marketing. Right. I mean, it's a marketing
Well,
play.
You mentioned like Coca-Cola earlier. Coca-Cola hasn't really developed a brand new product lately. They tend to buy existing. They're letting the market find the next great product. They're not innovating in... like energy, they're buying Monster, or they're not innovating in coffee. They're, in with Green Mountain.
Yeah, but let me, I want to defend Coca-Cola a little bit on that.
You
front.
Do that.
I think that allowing the market to establish winners and losers is fairly innovative, right?
Right, I mean, but that's their R&D, is the other people are doing it and they're trying to just pick the right horse.
Yeah, but the R&D is looking at, if you take a platform like Monster or Glisso or anyone else and put it on Coca-Cola, they understand the marketing. I mean, everybody understands the marketing.
Right, and distribution.
But there's also, on the R&D side, how are they innovating the supply chain? How are they improving? Those are hands-on stories you don't hear about, that I'm sure when Glisso got purchased, there was a team of engineers that went into their manufacturing facilities and looked at how they did business
and
innovated everything they could and applied those best practices.
Right. But the point is that, and you mentioned this earlier, the innovation may not be the obvious one that the consumer sees. It might be these other things, these other services and other parts of their business that are kind of behind the scenes and not as sexy.
But I think that's the 90%. I mean, that's the iceberg under the surface of the water. That is where most of the innovation happens, right? I mean, Coca-Cola has the same sort of information security needs that any other large enterprise has, but nobody's going to talk about what they're doing in that space for an innovation purpose, even though deploying great solutions in that space is absolutely innovative.
Right. And I think if you look at like the Coke Freestyle is a great example. I mean, it's been out for several years now.
Yep.
Why aren't there other competitors out there? Why haven't they just popped up? You know, there's
a lot of money.
There's a lot of technology in that. Right. I mean, people don't realize how much technology is in that. And so that becomes a great competitive advantage for them. Now all of a sudden they have something like Freestyle in all these stores and can put lots of product at the fountain versus, you know, the four or five options.
Now, and also I think this is where the value that you guys come in is you can go to an entrepreneur and go, look, have you considered Coca-Cola? And it may not even be on the radar of this entrepreneur of their specific service that they provide that Coca-Cola would be a need, because they may see Coca-Cola as only a beverage company and we don't do beverages, so that's not really what we do.
That's exactly right. Right. I mean, again, my point was Coke has the exact same information security concerns, the exact same sort of fintech payment kind of concerns. So there's an opportunity if you have an innovative product or service, particularly, I mean, what Atlanta does well on the startup front is develop these B2B plays, right? If you have a great platform or a great technology that's going to help a company operate more efficiently, sure, you should be talking to the right people at Coke. You should absolutely be talking to the right people at Home Depot. There are much more similarities between these companies than there are differences.
Right. And then if somebody wanted to learn more, website, Twitter feed, where do they go to learn more about?
CombineATL.com.
And then both the entrepreneur and the enterprise can reach out to you there.
Yeah. And then we're both on Twitter, and I'm sure you'll have us tagged and everything.
Sure. And then Ty Atlanta, if they want to learn more about the August 12th event at the Sheraton in Sandy Springs.
It's Atlanta.
Ty.org website.
There you go. And we will be there. You know, usually the event starts at a certain time. We're usually there early. So I highly, you know, it's a great opportunity to get time with me and Hans and David Harvey's amazing, and Burt Carrington, who's done a lot with supplier diversity, hands-on. So we're all going to be there ahead. You know, we're not just going to show up and talk. We'll be there ahead of time.
There's a lot of networking and a lot of question Q&A. It's not just people talking and then you guys leave.
So I think if any entrepreneur is serious about doing business with big companies, they should absolutely be there.
And then don't forget, TyCon is September 12th at the Waverly. You can learn more about that event as well, which is kind of one of the great events Ty puts on every year.
Absolutely, and we've had great speakers and very accessible speakers. We've had Alan DeBerry there with AirWatch. We've had Jeff Sprecher with ICE, Halo Model Mog with the Chamber. And they don't just show up and talk, they interact. I think it's one of those unkept secrets in terms of events that people just... We get pummeled with events in this town.
Sure.
But TyCon's one of those ones.
And then you can learn more about that event as well at atlanta.ty.org. Thank you both for being part of the show today.
Sure thing. All right, thanks for having us.
This is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.